Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
Oh, thank you so much for being with us today. I still have ears left. No thanks to Dan Gould with those headphones all the way up. It is a beautiful Sunday morning. Now we're here in spring. Correct guest, Carolyn Englehard. How are you?
I'm well. How's the audio?
I'm not sure yet. I still have jingle bells ringing in my ears. My producer, who supposedly likes me, had the volume all the way up. Woo!
Okay.
All right, but we're good now. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Of course, Rick.
An interesting yet difficult topic to discuss. We have to reach out to the experts such as yourself.
Thank you. It is complicated and complex and a very dynamic landscape. Things are moving quickly. I'm not sure what your listeners would like to hear, but maybe I should take a few minutes to just summarize what's been going on.
Well, we're going to talk about Affordable Care Act,
right?
Otherwise known as Obamacare.
Right.
And the American Health Care Act, also known as Trump Care.
Exactly.
And sort of where things have gone through the laundry wash.
Right.
In the last, 2 months?
Right.
4 months?
Sure. Well, of course, we could say over the last 7 years. When the ACA was initially passed, or we could benchmark it from January 1, 2014, when the Medicaid expansion and the health insurance exchanges went live.
But Trump Care didn't exist then.
No, last summer.
Or since the election in November of 2016.
Right, right. But before the election of 2016, last summer, Speaker Paul Ryan, put together a blueprint called A Better Way for America, where he outlined a bunch of public issues, one of which was health care. And the American Health Care Act was based on that blueprint. So I think that before we can talk about where we are, we need to understand where we've come from. So let's just remember what life was like in the insurance world before the Affordable Care Act, aka Obamacare, where 49 million people didn't have health insurance, where about 15 million who tried to buy health insurance on the individual market because they didn't get it through their jobs, or they didn't get it through Medicare, or they didn't get it through Medicaid, had to go to the open market to buy health insurance. And in that open market, it was like the Wild West. You could not be sold health insurance if you had diabetes. You could be sold a plan with no maternity coverage, no mental health coverage. Really, you could be charged up to 7 times more if you were older than if you were younger. And so Obamacare really came to be to look and address the problems in that market, as well as to provide access to health insurance for the uninsured. That's what the ACA was about. It wasn't about really changing employer-sponsored health insurance, where over 50% of us get health care coverage. It wasn't about changing Medicare very much. It was about changing Medicaid. So it's important to realize that while most Americans were pretty happy with their health insurance before Obamacare made a lot of changes, some of which people liked and some of which people didn't like. I'd say the pluses of Obamacare were that 20 million people received health insurance that didn't have it before. Now, about half of that came through the Medicaid expansion, and not all states expanded their Medicaid program. And I'm not saying the Medicaid expansion was good or bad. It just was. But it allowed people who had heretofore been chronically uninsured to get health insurance if they were low income, really low income, like we're talking under $16,000 a year low income. And it provided subsidies for folks to get help buying health insurance on these exchanges. And probably the most important thing Obamacare did, and if you're what we call liberal, you thought it was a great idea. And if you're what we call conservative, you thought it was a terrible idea. And that was to regulate the health insurance industry such that insurers could no longer refuse to sell insurance to people with poor medical history. They couldn't charge women more than men. And they could only charge old people three times more than young people. And because of that, that changed the structure of health insurance and moved us more towards what we call a social insurance product or program. And so when the Republicans came into power after the 2016 presidential election, where we now had the House of Representatives and the Senate and the executive branch all of the same party, there was this desire and a belief that it was a mandate from the election that Obamacare would be repealed. And so that's sort of where we are now.
Again, our guest today on Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, Carolyn Engelhard. She is a UVA professor and health policy analyst in the Department of Health Sciences at the UVA School of Medicine. That's what makes her the expert to have on the show today to talk about Obamacare and Trump Care, the affordable issues and what makes them affordable or not affordable, depending on which side of the line in the sand that you're standing on. So, Professor Engelhard, we're talking about this. Depending on how far you want to go back, for me, we still come to the election, and the expectation is that after 40 some times when President Obama was in office, the attempt to repeal Obamacare failed, that once there's a Republican president in office, finally, that's what's going to happen. They can take away the Affordable Care Act and put in place, whether it's Representative Ryan's plan or another, here we go. Let's make it happen. We have a Republican House, a Republican Senate, and a Republican president.
Right. Well, it's a cautionary tale, isn't it, Rick? It's about the difference between how easy it is to be against something than to actually change something. I think if history tells us anything in American politics, particularly with regard to social programs, it is that it is much easier to give something than to take it away. And that once people get used to having something, they're loath to give it up. That was why there was, believe it or not, the same kind of debate that happened in the mid-60s when Medicare was passed. There were factions, the AMA most particularly, who lobbied very hard against passing Medicare. And I would submit that Medicare is now loved by everybody. So part of this has to do with the growing pains of having a new social program. But it's also very important to think about it ideologically, because it does represent a shift towards more government interference in everyday life, and whether Americans like that or they don't like that. But anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. Yes, the Republicans passed about 60 times in the House of Representatives to repeal Obamacare. It's so interesting. Ever since 2010, when the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, was passed, there have been public opinion poll after public opinion poll. I could show you a graph that that is a composite of 50 different opinion polls since 2010, and they would show you that the majority of Americans disapproved of the ACA, generally speaking, for the whole time. And yet, when you asked Americans, well, do you like the part where kids got to stay on your health insurance till they were 26? They said, oh, yes, we like that part. Well, do you like the part where health insurers have to give you insurance even if you've got a history of diabetes or heart disease? Oh, yeah, we really like that part. Well, do you like the part where health insurance companies can no longer not pay for a very expensive disease if you use up a certain amount of money? Oh, I very much like that part, too. Well, what part don't you like? Well, I don't like the fact that government's in my life, and I particularly don't like the part where they say everybody has to have health insurance, because I think that's just un-American, that government should make you do something. That was basically the debate. And so the Republicans, I think, and Donald Trump particularly, I mean, in some ways, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, became the symbol of everything everyone hated about government. And it just became that rallying cry, overly simplistically. And then, bam, Republicans get elected. They said, well, heck, we have voted 60 times to repeal this bill, and now we are going to be able to get it through. But what they found was that a simple repeal without a replacement really had no traction with the American public, because there is this pesky little economic principle called loss aversion. And loss aversion manifests itself insofar as people will work much harder to hang on to something they have than to go after something they don't know it will necessarily be better in truth. So it ran smack into this principle of loss aversion, where people went from not liking the Affordable Care Act for fill in the blank, don't like the individual mandate, don't like the high deductibles, don't like, and let me just say, the group of people who were most disadvantaged by the Affordable Care Act are the people the Republicans see as their core. And that tends to be people who are not poor, make over 400% of the federal poverty level, so that they would not be eligible for a subsidy under Obamacare. And before the ACA, this group of people, if they had to go to the market and buy it as individuals, could buy a bare bones plan with a high deductible that didn't have maternity coverage, didn't have mental health, didn't have things that drove up the cost, the price of the product. And after Obamacare, they really felt that sting of having to pay much more out of pocket for a comprehensive plan that was required under Obamacare, filled with things they felt they didn't need. And so that constituency remains anti-ACA. So I think what the Republicans found out was that to repeal it without a replacement strategy was not going to fly. And too much had gone by. 20 million people had health insurance now that didn't have it before. People loved having their young adult children stay on their health insurance. In fact, if you remember, President Trump campaigned on keeping those two features, a ban on pre-existing condition exclusions and young adults staying on their parents' plans. But in order to do that, you can't just repeal the ACA, you have to replace it. And in order to replace it and to keep those two principles, you have to think about the wider insurance market, and that's what makes it so complicated.
Sunday morning wake-up call here on our second Sunday in April. Our guest today, Carolyn Engelhard, professor at UVA, of health policy analyst in the School of Medicine. We're talking about the two different cares, the health cares out there in the United States. Carolyn, Donald Trump, President Trump, has been somewhat inconsistent with his offerings since, not since, just since his candidacy, but let's go back to January with his address to the nation. He said everybody should have health care. He said several things that he said in his address to the nation did not come up when they offered their first health care policy, the American Health Care Act.
Right.
Right. And then that didn't pass. Do you think that that didn't pass because of all the offerings in it? I know that for a lot of people, it was because the one group, the Freedom
Caucus.
Freedom Caucus.
Right.
Because the Freedom Caucus didn't like it, and they weren't heavily involved in it. I don't want to get too political. I realize that that's part of what you do. You also write for The Hill, which is a widely read political policy article up on The Hill in Washington, D.C.
It's the number one web news web read by congressional staffers.
But was it the meat of what made up the policy, or was it the speed which it was trying to be passed in effectively like 2 weeks?
So all of the above. I think the Republicans were naive to think they could, number one, rush something through. It took the Affordable Care Act 18 months.
Well, you say they.
I met the Republican majority in the House. It failed. It never left the House. It stayed in the House of Representatives. It didn't even come to a vote.
But when we go back to they, do you think that Paul Ryan was one of them? Or is he sitting on the sidelines going, wait a minute, President Trump, this isn't going to happen in 2 weeks. And he's being overwhelmed by the president going, I don't care what you say.
No,
I'm giving you 2 weeks to make this happen.
Well, certainly we can pick that apart. I think part of the reason Donald Trump got elected president is because he was viewed as an outsider. And what happens when you're an outsider is, by definition, you don't really understand what's going on inside. And what's going on inside are the politics. And the reason John Boehner left as Speaker of the House is because he could not control the Freedom Caucus. When you have 30 members who are very, very, very conservative and vote as a block, they can stop almost any piece of legislation in the House. So I think Paul Ryan came in thinking he could work with the Freedom Caucus, and people in the House, the Republicans in the House, really wanted Paul Ryan to be the speaker. But what happened in this case, I think, was, yes, a president who didn't understand that in order to get legislation through, you have to bring in the stakeholders. I mean, you have to bring in the physician groups, the hospital groups, pharmaceutical industry, the health insurance industry. You have to line up your champions, because these are the people who bring with them tremendous power and campaign contributions that can kill or facilitate the passage of a bill. I think Trump wanted, I mean, I think we could all agree, whether you are pro-President Trump or anti-President Trump, that he tends to be someone who operates at a very gut level with instincts, and he, you know, he says that he wants to operate government like business, and so he wanted to get it through quickly. He wanted to make a deal. He uses those words. He wanted to negotiate. He wanted to get the deal done. Well, it's harder to do that in a political environment. So I think Speaker Ryan was a little bit naive that they could just railroad this thing through without doing their homework with regard to all the stakeholders. And also, he may have underestimated just how powerful the Freedom Caucus was in drawing the line in the sand that they were not going to allow this replacement, if you call it that, that would be along with the repeal, to look anything like Obamacare. Because in conservative orthodoxy, government would get out of the way of the insurance industry, and the insurance industry would operate in such a way that the market would decide whether or not a product was attractive, and that would drive the price structure, and that would drive supply and demand. That's what markets do. But what had happened was the American people liked some of the features of Obamacare, and President Trump said he was going to keep some of the features. Ban on pre-existing condition exclusions and adult children being able to stay on their parents' plans. Those two things, by definition, insert government into insurance and the regulation of insurance. And from the Freedom Caucus standpoint, they were like, nah, that's like Obamacare light. We're just not going to vote for it. And so Paul Ryan could not get the votes in the House. There were as many on the moderate side. Remember, there are 20 senators. I don't know. I can't remember the number of House of Representative folks from Medicaid expansion states. 31 states expanded Medicaid, which meant they were getting a huge influx of federal dollars. If the American Health Care Act would have substantially changed Medicaid, not just the expansion, but the whole Medicaid program by turning it into a per capita allotment or a block grant, and particularly those states that expanded their Medicaid programs, those legislators and those governors would have seen a lot less federal money. And so the moderates in the House said, you know, we really do want to keep, we don't want this to just take everything away. We want to keep the best parts. And the Freedom Caucus said, you keep any of those parts, and we're calling it Obamacare Lite, and we are not going there. And Paul Ryan couldn't broker those two factions, and so finally they just packed up their bags and went home for Easter.
11:23 here on the Wake Up Call, talking about the Affordable Care Act versus the Affordable Health Care Act, Obamacare versus Trump Care, whether we're going to have repeal and replace or just remain, with our guest today, Professor Carolyn Engelhardt from UVA's School of Medicine. Hang tight on a beautiful April Sunday. And here we are back. It is a beautiful Sunday. Hopefully you're listening while you look outside or drive down the road or through podcast. You're welcome to call up with your question or comment, 434-284-9470. We are here taking calls today. A little further explanation, specific question. We have the expert here in the studio. Now is your chance. Carolyn Engelhardt. She is a UVA professor and health policy analyst at UVA School of Medicine, Department of Public Health Sciences. Professor, I had some things. So if you go one versus the other, and that's sort of a rough way to put that, but I want to sort of toss out some things, and if you'll tell me the differences.
Okay.
All right. So is there one that's better or expected to be better? Because the American Health Care Act is not obviously not in place yet. And what's the CBO stand for?
Congressional Budget Office.
And so what they did was they looked forward and did their future expectations on how it would work out financially.
And the ramifications, what would change. And what the CBO said, so there were two iterations. The first American Health Care Act was scored by the CBO. Let me just tell your listeners, the Congressional Budget Office There is a law, a rule in Congress under the Byrd rule that basically says any legislation has to be scored with regard to whether it increases the deficit over a 10-year period. And it's generally believed that if a bill is going to increase the deficit over a 10-year period, then it's sort of dead in the water. So this CBO scoring is very important to all legislation coming forward with a fiscal impact. So the American Healthcare Act was scored initially by the CBO, saying that it would not increase the deficit over 10 years. In fact, it would reduce the deficit by a certain amount. And that, but that at the end of 10 years, 24 million more Americans would be uninsured than if the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, stayed in place. So that was disappointing. And then the difference between the main...
Let me follow.
Okay.
Disappointing to who?
To Paul Ryan and company, because politically, moving forward with a bill that basically says that this the American Healthcare Act would completely wipe out the coverage protection or expansion under Obamacare... is not really a true replacement. It's just saying Obamacare was bad and we don't care if you're uninsured and good luck. And so, you know, I should also say that by this time, by the time the American Healthcare Act had come to the point where the CBO scored it, many Americans had weighed in, and there had been many surveys, and it only had 17% approval, and that's very low. So that meant even the core Trump voters and others were thought that there were problems with this bill. Now, I need to go back just a little bit to help your listeners understand why there could never be a full replacement of the Affordable Care Act, and that's part of the problem. So in the Senate, in order for legislation to be acted upon, there has to be 60 votes in the Senate to get it out of committee so it can go to the full Senate for a vote. That's called a cloture vote, or to prevent a filibuster. Right now, there are 52 Republicans in the Senate and 46 Democrats and two independents that caucus with the Democrats. So they knew that a full replacement of the ACA would require 60 votes in the Senate that weren't there. But there is a budget technique called reconciliation. And I know this is the part where people's eyes glaze over, but it's important to understand, because what a reconciliation bill does is it allows a piece of legislation that's standing to be tacked on to a budget resolution, and you can change that original bill's language and fiscal impact, but you can only target those aspects of the bill that have a fiscal impact. So reconciliation of Obamacare is what the Republicans were talking about doing. That was the mechanism, this reconciliation technique on a budget bill. But it could only change things that had a fiscal impact, like the individual mandate penalty or Medicaid expansion funding or subsidies for individuals to buy health insurance on the exchange. But what it could not do, it could not change the bones of Obamacare, like regulating insurance companies to take all comers, the ban on pre-existing condition exclusions. So it couldn't change some of those pieces. All it could do was take away the funds that supported those pieces. So the Republicans were skating on sort of thin ice, trying to bring in more pieces that would fill in those things while still remaining within the parameters of the reconciliation. And what was passed 60 times in the House of Representatives was just a straight reconciliation bill, which just said, we are going to defund these parts, period. We're not even going to talk about trying to fill it back in or replace. We are just going to take it away. And that's what the Freedom Caucus wanted, was that. But people knew if you did the reconciliation without trying to address these other pieces, number one, you would not do what the president promised he would do, which is to protect those with pre-existing conditions. And more importantly, it would force insurers to leave the market, because without the subsidies to help people buy insurance, you can't force the insurance industry to take all comers unless they know people can afford to buy plans and get insurance. So it was a sure bet that just by taking all the money out of the ACA, the insurance industry would leave the individual market and would implode, which meant that at least 20 million people would lose their health insurance. And that is a dangerous political thing to do, particularly when the 2018 midterm elections are not that far away.
Again, our guest today, Professor Carolyn Engelhard. Excuse me, pollen is in the air. Professor Carolyn Engelhard with us today as we talk about the two CARE Acts, Affordable Care Act and the American Health Care Act. Obamacare versus Trump Care is in the air as well. So, Professor, I'd like to know how they match up versus one another versus keeping prescription costs down. Is one better versus the other?
No, I don't think so. I think the cost of prescription drugs is not in either of those bills. That is a separate issue, and it just bespeaks the power of the pharmaceutical industry and the crazy way that our drugs are priced. So I don't think it would make a huge difference, except that if fewer people have health insurance, fewer people will have prescription drug coverage. So presumably fewer people will buy drugs. So there might be less spending on the pharmaceutical consumption side, but that doesn't necessarily mean drugs would be cheaper. Now, during the election, both candidates for president, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, both ran on a platform of allowing Medicare to negotiate the price of pharmaceuticals directly. Under the Medicare Modernization Act of 2003, which established the prescription drug program under Medicare, Medicare Part D, it explicitly stated in that legislation that government could not negotiate the price of drugs with the pharmaceutical industry. And many people have been critical about that because other large countries do exactly that. It's called price controls. And we can talk about what's bad about price controls. The pharmaceutical industry would say that it reduces the incentives for innovation because few drugs make it to market, and so they have to charge more for the successful drugs so they can roll that money back into the research and development. But other countries have price controls, and because of that, our name brand drugs are up to 500 times more expensive than drugs in other countries. Neither the Affordable Care Act nor the American Health Care Act explicitly addressed that problem with pharmaceutical spending. The biggest difference between the two bills really had to do with the structure of the subsidies that enabled people to buy health insurance. Under the Affordable Care Act, the subsidy was indexed to your income, and then the subsidy came relative to the rate of an insurance plan in a geographic region, so that if you lived in New York City, your subsidy would be greater because the plan there would cost more probably than it would, say, in Charleston, West Virginia or something. What the American Health Care Act did is said, no, we're not going to do that. We are going to make these subsidies indexed by age and irrespective of geography. So if you're young and healthy, if you're just young, period, you get $2,000. And if you're older, you get $4,000. But we're going to take away this rating ban so that older people don't have to pay more than three times more than a younger person. We're going to allow, under the American Healthcare Act, to push that to five times more.
All right, now you started to lose me.
Okay, good. So, I mean, not that good that I lost you, but this is what I need to know.
So the Affordable Care Act under Obamacare, I got a subsidy because based on
Income, based
on how much money I made,
right,
and on the area of the country I lived in, because some areas of the country are more expensive to live in.
So basically the way, yes, so you...
Albemarle is more expensive than Fluvanna.
Right, I don't know that.
I mean, they're not that detailed, but for a local radio example.
Yes, probably Albemarle is more expensive than Biloxi, Mississippi.
Okay. So, but now the new thing is age.
Right.
Doesn't matter whether I'm young and poor versus old and wealthy.
Initially the American Healthcare Act did not have an age limit. People sort of screamed about that, saying, you know, well, Bill Gates would get it then. And so they said, okay. So then they put the salary ceiling at $75,000, which is significantly more than the Obamacare. Obamacare's ceiling for subsidy was 400% of the federal poverty level, which is about $46,000 for one person.
Okay, so young and poverty still gets less than old and middle class.
Correct. And if you saw some of the charts that put out during the debate, you would see that the winners under the American Healthcare Act were the people I talked about earlier, the young professionals who makes more than $45,000 and who then had to buy these bells and whistle kinds of health insurance plans. That group now would be able to get a subsidy if they made up to $75,000 a year. So the idea was that group would be a lot happier, but the poorer people who only got $2,000, it varied by age, so that if you were maybe 40 years old, maybe you got $3,000, but the health insurance you would have to buy was maybe, if it's a family health insurance plan, it could be as much as $18,000 a year, and you and your partner might each get $3,000, but it didn't begin to compare to the coverage that Obamacare provided. So the winners under the American Healthcare Act tended to be people who were healthier, wealthier, and a little bit older. And the people who suffered under the American Healthcare Act were people who were poorer and older.
Healthier, wealthier, and a little bit older. So matching the people who are already in Congress making the bill.
And who vote?
Yes. 11:39 here on the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call with our guest today, Professor Carolyn Engelhardt. Be right back. Back in action here on pollen-filled Sunday morning. Obamacare repeal and replace or just remain, with our guest, Professor Carolyn Engelhardt from UVA School of Medicine, talking about health policy or not.
So we left with your indignation about the American Healthcare Act benefiting those who perhaps didn't need it as much as the lower income. And that's interesting. And I said yes, because those people are the voters. And it used to be a dirty little secret that only political scientists talked about, that politicians really didn't care about poor people because poor people don't vote. But in truth, we learned in this last election that poor people do vote. And in fact, studies now suggest that the repeal efforts of the American Healthcare Act and other bills like them would negatively affect 6 out of 9 Trump voters. So I do believe that that came to be known among folks in the media, and eventually that trickled down to people themselves, and that's why the American Health Care Act only had a 17% popularity rating by the public, and why it couldn't get very much traction in Congress, also because of the factions happening in the House of Representatives, but also because I do believe Americans now have a different expectation that that they believe that there should be help available to people to be able to buy health insurance. And one of the things you said earlier, Rick, is really important, and I want your listeners to understand this difference. The language of the American Health Care Act and of most Republican bills uses the word access. They want every American to have access to affordable health care. That's very different than Obamacare or the ACA that said we want to have subsidies and cost sharing available to people to afford health insurance, and we want to mandate that people have health insurance so everyone can be in the insurance pool and not only sick people sign up. As Senator Sanders said, and I really don't mean for this to sound like a partisan discussion, but Senator Sanders said with talking about the difference between access and coverage, he said, well, I might have access to buy a multi-million dollar home, but that doesn't mean I can afford it. So when you use the word access to health care or to health insurance, that's code for we want to have a product out there people can buy if they can afford it. But the reality is, under the American Health Care Act, there were many people who couldn't have afforded it with the way the subsidies were structured. So I think people understood that. That's why the popularity was low, and that is why I believe Americans have shifted their perception about the role of government in providing some kind of health, because health insurance, health care generally, is so expensive. It's just unbelievably expensive. And right now, the fastest growing insurance product, not just on Obamacare, but in employer-based health insurance, the fastest growing insurance product is a high deductible health plan. And something like 40% of all health plans out there have deductibles over $1,000, some over $2,000. And for people who don't make a lot of money, you have to ask yourself, is that really health insurance? It's catastrophic health insurance, but it means people may not be able to pay for their medications or go to the doctor or whatever. So this is the landscape that we live in right now with health insurance and health coverage and price and cost and people's incomes. And for the last 30 years, medical spending has grown much faster than the general economy. And until we do something about, as you mentioned before, prescription drugs, until we do something about how much healthcare costs, we really won't be able to put our hands around this problem of insurance regulation, which is really what the ACA mostly was about and what the American Health Care Act tried to address and change was how insurance worked in this world, not about how much we spend on healthcare or how expensive different parts of healthcare is.
Well, let's talk about the change in the American Health Care Act from version 1 to version 2.
Okay, so version 1 was, as I mentioned, these subsidies based on age, and
it had the Obamacare light part to it, correct? It was can't be rejected for pre-existing conditions and things like that, that turned off the what's the name of that?
Freedom Caucus.
Freedom Caucus.
Right.
And it was that bill got turned down, turned away, and President Trump said, fine, it falls when it collapses and goes bad, it's the Democrats' fault.
So, right. And basically, the between version one and version two was putting a cap on the ceiling for income. They tightened up the enrollment procedures so that the enrollment every year would be shorter. People wouldn't be able to sign up as easily when they had what's called a special event. Insurers had been saying that part of the reason the exchanges weren't working under Obamacare was that people were waiting to buy health insurance until they got sick. That's called adverse selection. If you have too many sick people in your insurance pool, then nobody can afford it. And so they would say, you know, people would sign up, they would have their medical care taken care of, and then they would drop their insurance policies. Or they wouldn't buy insurance because the penalty was so much cheaper than the plan. And then they would get sick, and then they would say there was a special event in their life, and then they would be able to sign up and get health care, and then they would drop it or something. So that whole enrollment got tightened up, and the insurance company were happy about that. And then they talked about having what's called a high-risk pool for people who were sick and didn't have health insurance. They wouldn't go on the exchange. They wouldn't go into the health insurance pool and make it a sicker pool, but they'd be carved out and join a special pool that would be government subsidized. So they tried to make it a little bit more palatable to supporters of the ACA, but it just distanced the Freedom Caucus even more. And that's kind of where we are now. So Paul Ryan basically said, you know, I'm not going to bring this up again unless I know I have the votes. And in fact, right before Easter recess, the vice president came down and tried to resurrect something, because I think the president had said, and I think Paul Ryan felt, that these Republicans who had campaigned on a repealing Obamacare and had been struggling, you know, for the first 3 months in office, were going home for 2 weeks with sort of nothing to show for it. And so they, at the very last minute before they left town, put an amendment on this American Health Care Act. Now, remember, it's still never come up for a vote. They put an amendment on it that said that there would be this risk pool adjustment, which could either be viewed as allowing sicker people to get health insurance in a special pool just for themselves that would be subsidized, or it could help defray very expensive patients for insurance companies. That's called reinsurance. That's what the ACA had for the first 2 years. And actually, when it was in effect, premiums went down. The insurance industry would love to have that back again. It's in Medicare Part D. It basically says to insurance companies, you take people who are sicker than another insurance company, and we will help make you whole, since you can't turn people away. And so they put this language in literally hours before they left town. And we don't know the fate of that. We don't know if they come back, whether it'll have any legs. Clearly, the president and the speaker want to move on to something else, like tax reform. There are a couple of really big dates coming up. One is the end of April. This continuing budget resolution has to be renewed, or government will shut down. We don't pass budgets anymore in the United States. We just have continuing resolutions, because Congress can never agree on a budget. So we pass continuing resolutions for 2 or 3 months. We just sort of kick the can down the road, and then politicians come back and they fight about it, and then they either do another continuing resolution or whatever. So the end of April, there's a continuing budget resolution, and I think they would like to have an infrastructure, the president would like to have an infrastructure bill looking, starting to be talked about. They'd like to talk about some sort of tax reform. They campaigned on reducing the corporate tax rate. They want to move on beyond health care reforms so they can actually do some things that they feel they can go back and tell their constituents they've been successful doing. So the end of April is the first big important date. Another really big important date that we haven't talked about a lot today is the end of May. The end of May, I hope I don't lose you and your listeners. So ironically, when Obama was president, the House of Representatives sued the president, or sued the Secretary of Health and Human Services, at that point, Sylvia Burwell, and basically said, there are monies under the Affordable Care Act that help low-income people pay their out-of-pocket expenses, insurance expenses. We did not appropriate those dollars after the first year of the ACA. Only Congress can appropriate money. The federal government found ways, other buckets they paid it out of. And so the House of Representatives sued the government and basically said, you know, this isn't right. What would happen without those monies to help low-income people is that the insurance company would be on, the insurance industry would have to pick up those dollars, and they would clearly go into the red, and they would leave the insurance market, which means, again, as we talked about earlier, it would just implode and millions of people would lose their health insurance. So that case was heard at the district level, and the first judge sided with the plaintiffs, which was the House of Representatives. The Obama administration appealed it and asked that the cost-sharing reductions, these subsidies, continue as it wound its way through the different levels of the judiciary, and the judge said, okay. Fast forward to November 2016, we now have a Republican president. We have this bill out there where basically now the Congress is suing the administration of the same party. So you think, well, that's good. They're the same party. They'll just let the lower court stand, ruling stand. The lower court ruling stands. It means that that the cost sharing reduction, the subsidies will go away unless Congress reappropriates the money and the insurers will leave the market. So end of May is when that decision will come down, whether or not it's going to go forward. And then the end of June is when the insurers have to declare whether or not they will sell plans through the ACA in 2018.
One of the things that comes from that story makes it sound fictional, and it's not. Why can't insurance companies sell across state lines?
They can.
I thought I had read several times that they can't sell across state lines.
That is a feature of the Republican plan. Not so. Several states have reached interstate pacts that allow them to do that. They've done it at the state level, and interestingly, no state has taken advantage of it. Why is that? Well, just imagine. So, you live in Massachusetts. Massachusetts has one of the most expensive health insurance plans because the plans cover tons of stuff above and beyond what Obamacare requires, and you say, I am really tired of this expensive health insurance plan. I'm going to go over to Live Free or Die New Hampshire, where they have cheaper plans. Okay, so maybe you can buy a plan from New Hampshire Blue Cross Blue Shield, but you live in Massachusetts. Where are you going to go to see the doctor? Who's going to be part of that provider network? Unless New Hampshire Blue Cross Blue Shield has a deal with the doctors and hospitals in Massachusetts, you're out of luck unless you want to drive to New Hampshire for your health care. So there's some real logistical problems with buying health insurance in another state.
All right, 11:56 here on the wake-up call. Just about 3 minutes left with Carolyn Engelhart. Carolyn, with everything that's going on, do you envision more states choosing the Medicaid expansion?
Oh, good question.
I mean, I realize that there aren't more Democrat governors.
Yes. There are 20 governors that have Medicaid expansion in their state. I know Governor McAuliffe made a kind of tried once again. He ran on expanding Medicaid. It never happened in this state. Kansas, interestingly, passed a Medicaid expansion. It was vetoed by their governor. I say, yes, I do think that if they think Obamacare is going to stay the law of the land, it makes sense to more states will go after more federal dollars. But I think what will happen more quickly is our new, so over 1,400 times in the Affordable Care Act, there is this language that says the secretary shall blank, which means the Secretary of Health and Human Services is a very, very powerful person. So Tom Price is an orthopedic surgeon. He was part of the Freedom Caucus. He's very conservative. And his number two person, the head of CMS, is a woman who structured the Medicaid program in Indiana that put in things like work requirements and paying premiums, things that were unheard of before in Medicaid. What I think is going to happen is there will be a lot more applications from states that say, let us do Medicaid our way. Don't let us get rid of some of these federal rules that say we have to do it a certain way. Let us make, you know, people make Medicaid contingent on looking for a job, make certain people pay premiums, have work requirements, personal responsibility contracts. And I think that the Secretary of Health and Human Services will be very kindly disposed to that. And so I do think we'll see more experimentation at the state level, not necessarily Medicaid expansion.
All right, Carolyn. 15 seconds. Do you think it's going to pass?
The American Healthcare Act? No.
All right. Well, you can see the podcast, read the podcast later. We'll have Carolyn on again in the future after the next change or further explanation because we always need it. And take care. We can always see you on SeavillePodcast.com because you'll speak again at the Senior Pepsi Center sometime soon. Take care.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC-LP Charlottesville.